Right. Let's do this in English this time, since we have Jonathan here today. Welcome to the monthly Norwegian Unix User Group member review. This month we have Jonathan Worthington here, talking about some neat features we need in Perl 6. Perl 6, especially useful for online things usable for system administration and other one-liners and stuff like that. A few messages before we start. We will be going across the street to have some food and beer afterwards, so you're very welcome to join us then. We have a membership list that should be a paper going out somewhere. Peter, did you bring? Oh. Right. If you guys are interested in getting news about happenings, things going on in Noob and such, then get in touch with some of us. We'll add you to our mailing list. Other than that, welcome. And Jonathan Worthington, I hope you can entertain us a little today with your wise words.
I'll do my best. So hi everyone, thanks to Noog for inviting me here. It's wonderful to be in Oslo again. I'm originally from England, but I'm living in Lund these days, so it's been a kind of nice, relaxing train journey up here today. So who am I? I'm a Perl 6 hacker. I'm one of the core developers of Recudo, which is a Perl 6 compiler. I mostly focus on things like the object model, the type system, multiple dispatch, signatures, and all these kinds of things. So if you're using a lot of these features in Perl 6, in Recudo, then I've probably been involved in making a lot of those happen, which has been really great fun to hack on. I also love to travel, and I've been quite a few places, partly with Perl conferences and partly just tourism. And I like beer as well, but I don't like the price of it here. So the Perl 6 project, what's this project all about? I mean, you know, you hear about it and it started, you know, maybe 10 years ago or so. So the idea of the Perl 6 project is to take all of the things that make Perl great. Perl's great at being a glue language for sticking lots of disparate systems together and making them work together. Perl is really great for hacking up and prototyping stuff. But Perl, at the same time, is running big systems out there. You know, when I came here, I had to book a hotel. I went to booking.com. They're a huge site using Perl to run a very, very large business indeed. But there's some things in Perl 5 that don't really work quite so well. Things that were kind of, I guess, signs of the times and misprioritizations. Things that have changed in emphasis in the way that Perl is used, and just various things that once they got out into the real world were realized, you know, that maybe isn't quite so spot on and how it should be. At the same time, there's a lot of other languages out there that have happened since Perl has appeared, and since Perl 5 as well, and they have a lot of good ideas in them. You know, the Perl 6 development process is not insular at all. It's very much about saying, oh, this language had a really great idea. We should look at what we can do about that. But also, it's been a case of trying to borrow a bit from the research community as well. So, you know, what does academia turn out? Do they actually have anything interesting to say? And we've found in a couple of areas, including a couple of small ones I'm going to talk about tonight, that actually, yes, they do. And we've kind of borrowed some ideas from there as well. So in essence, the goal of the Perl 6 project is not to take Perl 5 and make a few incremental changes. The goal of the Perl 6 project is to build a new Perl language. That's why Perl 5 is still in active development at the same time as Perl 6 is being developed. So Perl 6 is a backwards compatibility breaking release. It's also not an implementation. So Perl 6 is the name of the language. There's a language specification, and there's a test suite. There's not one official implementation of Perl 6. just like other languages. So for example, you know, C, there's the GCC compiler, there's the Microsoft one, there's the Sun one. You know, C Sharp has the Microsoft one and some open source ones and so forth. You know, Ruby also has multiple implementations. So in Perl 6, we're kind of breaking the, you know, the only Perl can pass Perl thing. And Recudo is today's most complete Perl 6 implementation. So if you want to play with Perl 6 and experiment with it, this is really the thing to go and get hold of today. So the real thing I want to talk about is that different uses of a language really call for different priorities from the language. Let's just take a few situations. So, you know, one person might say, oh, I want a one-liner that computes the mean of all the values in the third column in this text file. Another person, I want to write a really large web application that manages train ticket sales for the whole country. So this is going to be a really, you know, big, elaborate, complex system. Then you've got the kind of in-between guy. I want a little tool that downloads and processes some file that's in some really arcane format once a day. It's not huge, but it's not tiny, but I just need to get the work done here. And then you've got the people with slightly specialist needs. People who, for example, have really large sets of data that they want to work with in memory. And in their case, they kind of maybe want the language to be able to give them some speed. They maybe want it to be able to store stuff nice and compactly. Things that people who were probably doing at least two of the previous three things don't have as a concern. In Perl 6, we've actually tried to make things better for all of these use cases. And I'd like to just spend a bit of time tonight showing a few features that I think are in Perl 6 and really highlight what we've done both over Perl 5 and over languages to try and make Perl 6 a quite interesting language for all of those areas. Obviously, I can't talk about the whole language. There's too much of it. But I hope that the features I show tonight will kind of give you something interesting to kind of go away and think about and maybe want to play with. So let's start out with the kind of the really little tasks. You know, the one-liners, the tiny things where you write it, you use it, and you toss it. One thing that has happened quite different from Perl 5 is that if you type Perl 6, hit enter, you fall into this redeval print loop. It gives you a prompt. And you can just start typing stuff in. And either if it outputs something, it'll show you what it outputted. Or if it doesn't do anything, it'll just evaluate the result. So, you know, you can just use it as a calculator. Or you can get it to decide what you're going to drink. So here, this angle bracket syntax just makes you a list of literal items, and dot pick is a method on that list, so it just picks a random thing from the list. Or you can, you know, step it up and do something kind of a bit more mathematically. So this is the 21st Fibonacci number. How does this work? Well, the three dots in there are what we call the series operator. It's for declaring a series. You'll recognize the first two digits over there on the left as the first two items in the Fibonacci sequence. And on the right-hand side, we've got inf. So we're making a conceptually infinite list here. Obviously, we're not going to make all of them. And then this star plus star is saying, I'd like you to make the next thing in the series by adding the previous two things together. And then we're just going to do an array index into it and grab the 21st Fibonacci number. So you can kind of see that even there, you can start just writing these little thingies in the REPL that can be quite useful. One of the things that you often do at the shell is pipe data, often text data, from one process to another. In Perl 6, one of the things that we really, really wanted to do really well in short programs and in compact space is let you do list processing. Perl 5 is really, really awesome at text processing, but if you want to start doing stuff with lists, generally you have to start writing a lot of loops. In Perl 6, we want to make it easy just to do stuff with lists of things. So in this case, I called the dir function, which gets me a list of all the files in the current directory. I then feed that list into grep, which is a Perl 6 built-in, and I pass it a regex. So I can grep out all of the files that end with the .pm in the file name there. Stepping it up a bit, though, I can, of course, still just pipe stuff into Perl 6 and then use the pipes kind of internally there as well. So what am I doing in this one? $start in is standard in. It means this is the file handle for reading from standard in. Slurp reads all of the stuff in. It just slurps all the data in. .comb is a way of saying I'd like to extract all of the things in the string that match a certain pattern. So in this case, I'm just going to grab all of the things that match that regex, essentially words. So at this point, I've just got myself a list that contains all of the words in this file essay.txt. Now, what I want to actually do here is figure out what the longest words in my essay are. So that's a sorting job. So I pass this list along to sort using this pipeline. What do I want to sort by? I want to sort by the number of characters in the word. So this star thing here makes you a little closure, which then is called on each of the things we're sorting to give the value that we're going to sort on. So you can read this sort as sort these values by the number of characters in them. We want to reverse the list so that we get the longest first. We want to join it with new lines, and then we want to say what this list is. And then we'll just pass it along to head so we only get the top. So that's kind of a kind of Perl 6 kind of shell fusion going on there. So slurp is good for reading a file into a scalar. So, you know, I could just very easily take a directory listing, shove the data in, grep out all the files I wanted like before, and then actually just read them in like that and sort by the number of characters in the whole file. Lines, on the other hand, is kind of interesting. Not so much in this usage. Here we are just using it as a kind of numification there. So we're saying, I want you to sort by the number of lines in the file. And you can kind of see it gives a slightly different output for those two. But lines also, if you put it at the start of the list, is actually going to read the file in lazily. So these pipelines here actually set up essentially a parallel chaining process to pull the data bit by bit through the list. So you don't have to go and read all of the data at once to work on it. So if you've got a 2 gigabyte file, you know, that's really kind of handy. So that's a nice way that you can just pass data around and very easily look at the kind of way it flows through your program. But I mentioned earlier that we could write a lot less loops. Well, here is the meta operators. A meta operator is something that takes an existing operator and does something different with it. The first one I want to show here is called the reduction. So we have a max operator in Perl 6. If you do $a max $b, then it will just return you the biggest of them. You can imagine if you write a big long list of values and put max between each one of them, then just out of associativity, you'll end up getting the maximum value from all the list. So these square brackets around the operator here essentially are the do this between every element in the list operator. So what am I doing here? Well, I'm finding the maximum of what? Well, I'm reading, again, slurping in all the stuff from $start in, and I'm extracting everything that matches backslash d plus, a number. So that basically finds all the numbers inside example.txt and adds them together. What if we just wanted to add up all the numbers in a particular, say, column in the file, though? Well, again, that's kind of easy. So we want to add up all of the things in a list. So we use the plus operator to add, and then put it in the square brackets to say, do this for the whole list. Then we're just going to take our lines from $start in, and we're going to call map on them. And what are we going to do? So maps takes each line and does something for it. And it says, well, we're going to call .words, which just basically breaks the string up on white space into a list. And then we're going to grab the second element from there, e.g. column 3. So this is just a little program that adds up all the stuff in, say, column 3. But what if I, you know, had two files and I wanted to take the differences between the values, you know, in column 3 in one file and in column 3 in the other file, and find the total of the differences? Well, again, we do the same kind of thing for each file. This over here is just a subtraction operator, minus, and this is another meta operator here. We call it the hyperop. And this one just means I want you to do this element-wise through the whole list. So it's going to, you know, take the first line, the second column from the first line, and then subtract the second column from the first line of the other file. And then we just add up all of the differences that we get later. So you can kind of see that in here, we've sort of got three implicit loops going on, but we haven't actually had to write a single loop. We can just write this very easily as kind of a one-line thing. So it's a little bit to take in at first, but what we've actually got here is a very effective way of dealing with lists of data with very little code. So what about if we need to build something just a little bit bigger? One thing that you almost always need to do when you write a tool is you want to be able to give it some options at the command line. So one of the things that we've done in Perl 6 is added subroutines that take signatures and that have parameter lists. So you can, you know, write something like this. I can write a sub foo. I can do that. And then I can call it like this. And this is kind of a nice little advance on what was possible inside Perl 5, because before you then had the at underscore to take parameters from. But if you write a subroutine called main in uppercase, we actually treat it specially. So here is just that little Fibonacci expression again that I had wrapped inside a main subroutine. And it takes two arguments. It takes a number. It's just a normal positional argument. And then we take a Boolean. This is, you know, a true or false thing. And we just call it, we put a colon before to say, I want this to be a named parameter. That's kind of one that you pass using a pair rather than just by position. So we have that. And then all we're going to do is print out all of the Fibonacci numbers up to that one. In the sequence, if up to is passed at the command line, or we're just going to print the one. So if I just do Perl 6 fib.pl 10, then it's going to, we didn't pass up to, so that's going to be false. So we'll just end up in this second case here. If I pass in up to, then that is going to be true. So there we are. But what if I don't pass in the right thing? In that case, it actually goes and looks at the subroutine that I wrote, introspects the signature there, and automatically generates a usage message for you. So just right away, you have, you know, just by writing a subroutine, you straight away have a command line interface for your program. Now, what if you wanted to do something a bit more complex? What if there was multiple commands that you could run? Well, just stepping away from the command line thing for a second, Perl 6 has this thing called multiple dispatch. And the idea of this is that you can write multiple subroutines with the same name, call them with different arguments, and then depending what you call them with, it will pick the appropriate one. So I've got a little snippet of code here from the Perl 6 test suite, and you can ignore pretty much all of it, apart from the lines that start multi-sub. And you'll see that one of them takes two parameters. One of them just takes one. So what happens here at runtime when we actually call this sub is it says, oh, well, are you passing two arguments or are you passing just one? And it'll pick the appropriate one for you. So if I extend this to the main sub, then I can write multiple main subs. And you can actually put literals in the signature as well to say, you know, I want the person to actually write that specific bit of text. So here, we just have a little utility script, and we want to either have the person write, you know, util send file name, or util fetch file name, or compare, and so on. And then it actually goes and automatically generates this usage message for us saying, oh, these are all of the different possibilities that you could actually invoke this program with. So that just makes your life that little bit easier when you're starting to write one of these command line applications. Now, I mentioned earlier that Perl has always been a really great language for dealing with text. And Perl 6 kind of wants to make your life even better and even easier there as well. So, instead of just supporting regexes, where essentially you feed in a bit of text and you get something back saying this matched or didn't match, and you can capture stuff as well using the parens, but essentially it's a completely flat, non-hierarchical kind of matching. So, you know, you're looking through the string and you're grabbing bits out of it, but then that's all you have. You have the positional captures, and you know, you have whether it matched or not. Perl 6 makes it possible to instead write some regexy stuff that gives you a tree back instead. It gives you some kind of more complex data structure, so you don't actually have to go and do all of the kind of parsing stuff and building it up yourself. It also means that you can encapsulate a lot of this stuff and reuse it. So let's take a practical example. So, you know, suppose you go and you're working at some new place, and you're given this weird data file that some old mainframe spits out, and they say, oh, well, this is the file that gives you, you know, the number of holidays that we sold to each of these different places in a day. And you kind of look through the file and you can see that it's got the country and it's got the place name and it's got the latitude and longitude, which we don't really need for now. And then over here, it's got, you know, the number of sales. So the task is that essentially we want to take this data, read it in, and then be able to pull out all of these different sales numbers and add them up by country. So we kind of look at this, and you know, it's like, oh great, what a lovely non-standard file format. But let's write a grammar for it. Because, hey, you know, if we're having to do something with this data today, chances are we're probably going to have to do something different with it tomorrow. So starting to write a grammar is as simple as just writing grammar and giving it a name. So we'll just call it sales export here. The first thing that happens when you try and parse something with a grammar is it invokes this thing called the top rule. And this is, if you like, it's the entry point. You know how your program kind of has a main sub? Well, a grammar has a top. And you might look at some of the stuff that's in between the curly braces there, and it almost looks sort of familiar in places. So the caret symbol there means the start of the string. The dollar that's on the end there means the end of the string. So this is all nice and familiar from regular expressions so far. The plus means one or more. Well, that's exactly the same. So the only weird thing that we've got inside here is this country in angle brackets. Well, if you think of when you write a program in sort of a top-down style and you write subroutines, well, then you write one sub and then, you know, you call another to do a bit of something and it hands back a result and then, you know, maybe it calls a few others and so forth. This is essentially a bit like a sub call, but in the regex world. It's saying, I'd like to actually call some other rule that's going to pass a country, and I'd like it to pass one or more of them. So a country is basically the name plus the various places in it. So we write a country token like this. So what we're going to match? Well, we're going to match a name. So this is going to be another rule that we'll have to define in just a moment, but we'll worry about that later. We want to match a new line character, backslash n, and then we want to match one or more destinations. So a destination is going to be just one line from this data here. Well, let's build this one up slowly because we're going to have to do a few things in it. So we know that it starts with a tab. And then it has a name. Again, we'll define that in a moment. then we have some white space. We'll be a little bit forgiving and maybe match, you know, multiple bits of white space there. We have a colon. Now, I've actually put that in quotes there. And if you just want to match some literal text anywhere in a regex, then you can just put it in quotes. It's just like anywhere else in the Perl 6 language. You can just make a non-interpolating string like that. Then after that, we want to match a bit more white space. Okay, so that's passed our name and the colon. Now, when I've been talking about all of these different calls so far that we're doing, I've actually only been telling you half the story. Because what's really going on here is that we're not only doing a call that gets some data back, we're storing that data under the name. So when we actually call country multiple times there to parse countries, what it's actually doing for you is building up an array that you're going to be able to retrieve later on that contains all of the stuff you parsed about countries. When you have a country and you look inside this array and pull out one of these objects, you're going to be able to get the name and you're going to be able to get an array of destinations. Now, one of the things that happens is that you want to start reusing rules. So we know that we want to pass, you know, two numbers here, but we want to give them a bit of a better name so we can get the latitude and the longitude out individually. So all I do here is I say I'd like to call this thing lat, but I want to assign to it what I match by calling the rule num. So essentially it's calling one rule and putting it in another name. So that's our latitude and longitude. And then last of all, the thing we really, really wanted out of all of this is this number of sales that's at the end there. So that's just going to be an integer. And again, we've used this syntax just to rename it. So we're almost done, but we're kind of missing, what are we missing? We're missing name. So let's define name. Well, name is just going to be some word characters, and then optionally, zero or more, space and some word. This square bracket here is kind of like a parenthesis, but it doesn't actually capture anything. It's just it's a non-capturing group. We stole the syntax from character classes, and they look a bit different now. The reason we have this is so we can match names like, you know, St. Petersburg or something that are two words. So we have that. And num and integer are kind of boring. It's optionally a minus sign and then a bunch of digits. And maybe for this one, we're going to have a decimal part on the num as well. So there we have it. We've written a complete grammar that not only will let us get the data we want from this file now, but we can stash this away, so next time we have to do something with this wonderful file format, we can just pull this out and say, oh, okay, well, you know, I can just use this to get the data. So, you know, for example, we might be able to then pull out the latitude and longitude and make some nice Google map or mashup or something that, you know, has a dot on it given the size of the number of sales. And it's easy to pull the data out now. So that's how we get from data to data structure. And just to kind of show you how we can work with this, let's finish off our little program. So what do we want to do in here? Well, first of all, we'd like to actually use the grammar. There it is, sales export. And we're going to call a method on it. So it's just like an object. You can call a method. And we're going to call the parse file method. We pass it a file name. Dump.txt, and it gives us back something that I'm just going to put in this variable called parsed over here. Now, what this is going to be is an object that represents all of the stuff that we've matched. So the first thing I really want to do at this point is say, well, did I actually successfully match anything? Well, that's easy, because if you just treat parsed as if it was a Boolean, you just write it in an if statement, it'll be true if it matched and false if it didn't. So we can very easily just die with a parse error over there. So let's fill out the rest. What do we want to do? The first thing I'm going to do is take this $parsed object, and I'm going to look up country. Now, country, if you remember back to the grammar, was what we captured all of the countries in. but it was actually quantified. Now the thing is, this is going to give us back a match object, but all we really want from it is the list of things in there. So what we're going to do is we're just going to say, oh, I'd like you to give me a list. Not the whole thing, just a list of countries that you matched. So now we have an array in countries which contains a bunch of kind of match objects representing every country that we matched. What now? Well, what we want to do is find the top country by total sales across all the destinations. So in Perl 6, on an array, you have a max method. And actually, if you just use it without any arguments, I can actually do, I can do things like this to give me the actual maximum there. But you can also optionally pass in a closure. And this closure says, I'd like you to work out the maximum, but not by the value itself, but by some other thing that I'll tell you about. So what is this other thing going to be? Well, it's going to be the number of sales from all destinations. So earlier back at the start, I showed you meta operators, and I showed this one. This is the meta operator, and it just takes the plus operator and does it between all the things in a list. So that's exactly what we want. We want to add up all of the different numbers of sales for all of the destinations in the country. So then we're going to pull the destinations out of the country. So in Perl 6, like in Perl 5, you have this kind of magical dollar underscore variable. And all this means is I want to look up the hash key destination out of this variable. So this is going to get the destinations for the current country. Now remember, just like we had country there earlier, and it was a list, again, this is just like a list as well. So now we want to get the sales out of there. Apart from, we're kind of looking at this and saying, well, don't we have to do some kind of loop? Because we actually want to go over this list of destinations, we want to pull each sales value out and make a list for the sale values. Well, yes, but in Perl 6, we can get it to do the loop for us. So to do a method call or to do a key lookup, I can write dot and then sales in angle brackets. If I want to actually do it over the list, all I have to do is just write a very slightly different operator like that. Now, this one here actually is, they're actually the French quotes. You can write it as two ASCII characters as well, just as two greater than's, but it looks a bit weird given the hash key. But essentially what this is going to do is take this destination, this list of destinations, and turn it into a list of all the sales counts. And then we just add them together. And then we're done. Because all we get back from that is the object that represents the top country. And then we just have to pull out the name of the country and say it. So there we have it. That's our full script. So grammars and the main stuff I showed you earlier are very much, about being a glue language. It's easier to get data into the application now and do stuff with it. And Perl 6 also makes it a bit easier to work with what we call native libraries. That is, if you wrote some library in, C, or you have one that you want to interact with, that's got a bit easier as well. So all we have to do is, at the moment anyway, is say use native call. We might pull this into core at some point. This is still being debated, but at the moment it's in the prototype. So we say, you put this use native call thing. And then all you have to do, imagine that I'm writing some kind of MySQL binding. I mean, in a small tool, you probably just want to call into some library much more as a one-off. But I'll show you an example from actually calling to the MySQL client library here. So all I do is write a subroutine, and then I just give it a bunch of parameters that match the types of the things, or I can just say it's a pointer of some kind, I don't care what, that the C function will want. So it's going to want a string, an int, etc. And it returns me some kind of pointer, which I don't really care about. So that's just a subroutine in Perl 6. It's a stub one. You see the dot, dot, dot there means I'm writing a subroutine, but I'm not going to define what it does. And then all we have to do is just say, oh, well, this is actually a native subroutine, and it's from the libmysql client. This will actually go off. It will read in the, it'll load, sorry, that C library. It'll look up MySQL Real Connect, and it'll then do all of the magic to actually make this a callable function from Perl, which marshals all of the things you pass over to C, which is kind of neat. And this isn't kind of a kind of so proof of concept that, you know, it doesn't really do anything yet. This is actual real copy-pasted code from the way we write the database interaction in Perl 6. So this library really is good enough to go off and connect to MySQL and Postgres and all of that lot. But if you just want to, you know, pop up some message box or, you know, do something with some strange C library, then, yeah, you just have it easily like that. So, yeah, profit. So we've been through the little things, you know, the really short little command line-y things. We've been through some things that help us write those intermediate kind of glue applications. But what if we were wanting to build a bigger system? Does Perl 6 actually have anything to help us there? One of the really big improvements in Perl 6 has been the object model. I don't know if you've used Moose from Perl 5. If you have, then the good news for coming to Perl 6 is that you'll find a lot of the concepts are the same. There's different syntax, but even there, you know, the keywords carry across. So if you've been using things like has in Moose, then you know that just works in Perl 6 as well. So writing a class now is as simple as just saying, you know, class beer has this attribute, so it's going to have a name. We have a method keyword. It's for writing a method, so you don't have to mess around with taking the self parameter anymore. That just is handled for you, and then, you know, we just interpolate this attribute into the string there, and that's absolutely all we need to do to write a class in Perl 6. So compared to Perl 5, you've got a bit less kind of munging to do. Though it's not so far off what Moose gives you, or particularly Moose X Declare. And if you are using Perl 5 and want to do sort of syntaxy stuff like this, or at least get the nice underlying object model like this, then Moose is very much worth a look. I'd very much recommend it. One of the things that we also get is a default constructor. And this constructor maps names arguments to the attributes. So I can create a new beer here. I can just pass in the name, and it's going to go and assign that to that name attribute there. So if I just call pint.describe, it's going to say I'm drinking Tuborg. So it's that easy to just write a class. You'll note here that the attribute storage is all taken care of for you. You don't have to worry, you know, is this going to go in a hash, or is it going to go in an array, or whatever. It's completely abstracted away. You don't have to worry about that. The other thing that's been taken quite seriously in Perl 6 is encapsulation of attributes. So here, there's no way to get at that name from outside of the class. On the flip side, in a lot of languages that do have all this privacy, writing accessor methods gets really, really boring. So in Perl 6, all it is a one character change to say, oh, actually, I want to make an accessor method for this. So instead of an exclamation mark there, you write dollar dot instead. And the dot kind of is a bit reminiscent of, you know, method call. So it means, you know, it's generating a method for you. And if you add SRW, then you actually get a method generated, which is what we call an L value method. So you're going to be able to change this thing. So here I can just create my new dog. Its name is Spot and its color is black. And then we can change its name. You know, at some point in the future. I mean, if you called your dog a silly name, you're allowed to change it. But you know, if your dog's black, then short of bleach, you can't really change its color. So this is actually going to fail if you try and do this. So you actually get this enforced, and it's protected for you. So you can write classes in Perl 6 and sort of have more control over the encapsulation and the way people can get at the data. Now, Perl 6 does support inheritance, of course, and it does support multiple inheritance, just as Perl 5 has. The thing about multiple inheritance is that it has various issues, things like diamond inheritance structures, and also especially a problem that we often refer to as fragile hierarchies. This is the case where you maybe add a method somewhere in your inheritance hierarchy, and you didn't quite realize that some class downstream of that that's inheriting now sees that method when it used to see a different one. And when you can potentially get into all these kinds of awkwardness. The trouble with single inheritance is that it doesn't really give you quite enough code reuse. So one of the things that we kind of borrowed from the academic world is roles. And roles basically they're a different approach to composing functionality in a class and sharing functionality in an inheritance. And in many ways, they're complementary to it. They have different use cases. So a bit like a class, you can write a role and it can have attributes and methods. The difference between a role and a class is that you're not supposed to actually use the role on its own. Instead, a role is kind of like a chunk of functionality that you are later going to stick into either an existing object or into another class. And you can then build classes up out of these roles. So, for example, if I have a logging role and that just logs some message to a log file there, that's just using the open syntax and doing the sort of object-oriented file write. Don't worry too much about that, but that's kind of what it would look like. But the important thing here is I have a role. It's got a method in there. And when I do class mail sender, I say does logging, it's going to take this method and stick it into this class. And it's almost as if you'd copy-pasted it, apart from it actually does, you know, some decent sharing behind the hood. But the semantics of it are as if you declared the method or the role right there in the class itself. So, you know, when we actually go and try to call methods at runtime, your roles have no runtime cost, really. You know, the methods and the attributes are all just completely flattened out into the class they're composed into. Now, if you try and supply a method in two roles with the same name, it's actually a compile time error. So we actually detect these things really early and flag them up to you and say, wait a minute, you can't do this. This is a case where you have two methods which both have the same name. You're going to have to disambiguate for me. So this is one of the really important things about roles. They don't go guessing. They actually make you take a conscious decision and declare that decision inside the class to say, oh, I really want this one. So you don't kind of get this fragility where maybe you change the ordering of something or you add a method somewhere else and suddenly it's getting called and you don't find out about it until runtime or maybe by the time the code has hit production. So, you know, if I have a role drinking, which is, you know, go to the bar, and they have a gymnastics role where the gymnast goes to the gymnastics bar, and I create a drunk gymnast class, then this is actually going to be a compile time error. It's going to say, you have two go to bar methods here. Which one is the gymnast going to do? And then you actually have to resolve this conflict. And how do you do it? Well, you can write a method in the class which makes a decision. So maybe the decision will be that we don't do either of them. Maybe the decision will be that we just do one or just do the other. Or it could be that, you know, we do both. You have complete freedom over how you resolve this conflict. The alternative, though it wouldn't work in the previous case, is that you may be in a situation where you have two methods from the role and they have different signatures, And you look at this and you say, well, okay, what I'd really like to do is have both of them. And, you know, I mentioned earlier you could do the multi-subroutines and they dispatch based on the arguments you passed, so the correct one. Well, you can force them to become multi-methods. So you can get both and then make a runtime decision about which one to call. So you can do that as well. So in this case, I've just done the simple thing. I've just said, I'd like to make a call on myself. Self is just means this object. And I'd like to call the go to bar method, but specifically, I'd like to call it from the gymnastics role. So it's there, you've disambiguated and said, you know, oh, I'd like to call that one. The object model also provides all of these shiny things, including especially these two at the bottom, which are really great for object model kind of extensibility, but also meaning that you can go and actually start looking at objects and saying, you know, oh, so what methods does it have? And you can even do this with the built-ins as well. You know, so if I take the int type and say what methods does it have, and I'm just going to get the ones declared directly on it, not everything up the hierarchy. And then I'm going to go over them and I'm going to get their name and then I'm going to say them. And yeah, it's come back and told me, oh yeah, you have all of these various list of methods. So you can actually go exploring your class hierarchy in the REPL using all of this as well. One of the other things that you can do, and I've sort of shown it but haven't really talked about it so far, is add what we call type constraints. Now, a type constraint is where you say, I want this variable, or I want this parameter, or I want this attribute to only ever be allowed to hold a certain type of thing. That might be a string, it might be an integer, or it might be, you know, some class you've defined on your own. You know, it might be a sale or an order or, you know, a product or something like that. And these are, you know, Perl is still a dynamic language at heart. So in that sense, you know, we can't do all of this checking at compile time, but the promise is that you'll definitely get them enforced at runtime at latest. If we can do it at compile time, if we can figure out enough, then we may do it then as well. But what it means is that you can start putting constraints into your code to kind of harden it and say, you know, if the value at this point isn't what I was expecting, then something is really, really wrong here, and I want to, you know, collapse and throw an exception. So here, you know, I have a subroutine, show distance, and it takes a string from a string to and an integer distance. So if I call this the correct way, like I do on the line four there, then I pass in, you know, Oslo learned and the number of kilometers, and it's all fine. If, on the other hand, I pass in the number of kilometers first by accident when I'm using this, then it's, I mean, if you didn't put any type constraints on there, then what's it going to do? Well, it's just going to come out and say, oh, from, you know, 495 kilometers to Lund is Oslo. So that's not very useful. So here instead, it's actually going to say, oh, wait a minute, for this parameter from, I really expected you to pass me a string, but you pass me an int instead, and it tells you, you know, what parameter, where it happened, and all of that lot. So you've got lots of information to go and track this down. So the benefits from this today are that you can add some kind of checks and balances into your application. So you can be a bit more sure that nothing is kind of going wrong. They can also sort of serve as decent documentation as well. But one of the kind of future benefits of this is something called gradual typing. And this is actually an area that I'm really actively working on at the moment. And the kind of excitement here is that the compiler will be able to take all of this information and make use of it to either do things like emit more optimal code or be able to kind of tell you at compile time, oh, you have this code, but it could never, ever possibly work at runtime. This emit more optimal code is actually one of the things that I'm working on at the moment. So we'll actually be able to use the type information, for example, to emit more optimal method calls, because we'll actually be able to, you know, narrow down the set of things we could call and be able to just dispatch it in a much more efficient way. So we're really close to being able to take advantage of this kind of information as well. So essentially the idea here is that you can be anywhere on this scale. You can go from just writing a program and not even thinking about types, which if you're writing a small tool or a one-liner or anything like that, you just don't want to think about them, I guess. Or you can really go all the way and pretty much get to the point where you have a fully statically typed program. And you can just pick your point on this scale depending on your situation, depending on the sort of program you're writing. And then the compiler will say, okay, you've given me this much information, and I'll try and do, you know, these useful things for you out of it. So essentially, the more info you give, the more it will be able to kind of try and help you there. So that's kind of one of the, you know, the things that we're doing to try and make big applications a bit more feasible. So some conclusions. So Perl 6 is really trying to be good for the little things and the large things. Not all of the features are applicable to both. So the gradual typing stuff I just talked about and all of the nice object-oriented things, you probably aren't going to do that much with them if you're just writing a one-liner. At the same time, if you're writing something that's going to have to be maintainable, then you probably don't want to stack up, 10 different meta operators on one line like you would in a kind of one-off throwaway one-line program. Essentially, Perl 6 really wants to give developers a sort of choice where they place themselves on this kind of production to prototype scale. So essentially, you can use the language in a very kind of quick hack sense, or you can use it in sort of the, this is a production-y system sense, and I'm going to architect things well, I'm going to use, classes, I'm going to factor stuff out with roles, maybe I'll use the type system to give me a bit more protection. But also, because you can actually start with an untyped program and add types, or you can start with a mess and break it out into classes and all of these kinds of things, essentially, there's a migration path from your quick hack to good code, whatever that means, without actually having to switch language. So Perl 6 not only tries to be the tool for the one-liners and the tool for writing these little utilities, and as well the tool for writing the big applications, we actually try and give you all the things you need to kind of move along that scale, to pick your point, and if you need to shift that point a bit later. Thank you very much. And I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Any questions? If you have some, please take the microphone here. There's one over there.
Yeah, hi again. Hello. Could you tell us a little bit about the current status on Rakuda and Perl 6 now? Is it close to being frozen and
Rakuda, freeze? Yeah, Rakuda at the moment is not doing at all bad on the features side of things. So I think it's fair to say that every single bit of code I've shown you today works on Rakuda. Most of it I actually tested anyway, to be really sure. So at this point, we run a lot of things, we implement a lot of features, and for a lot of the things you'd want to do, we have good coverage of the Perl 6 specification. The stage we're at the moment is that we've made a lot of it work, but now we need to make it kind of fast and efficient. So we're very much at the optimization stage now. And that's kind of, when I was talking earlier about the kind of gradual typing stuff, that's actually just one small part of a bunch of optimization work that I'm focusing on, sort of at the primitives side of thing. But we're also doing a lot of work at taking programs and saying, okay, where's the real cost in this? Why does this run, so slowly? And sort of working from sort of a top-down approach to the performance as well. So I guess the status is that, We're getting there. We have something you can download and play with today. Just don't expect it to be lightning fast or even slightly fast, depending on what you're doing. On the other hand, it's certainly good enough for doing, you know, little things here and there. I know I've used it for various bits and pieces in work. I know someone who's using it for, you know, doing fast prototyping of stuff that they then go and implement in C++. So yeah, it's usable today, but I'd say we have a bit of work left to do before you'd want to start, you know, trusting it with, you know, something really big or, you know, I mean it depends on your scenario, but you know I think with over the next year, I think we're gonna hit the point where it's getting to a stage where it's actually quite practical to start deploying it.
I have a question.
Okay.
Right now, who is Persix for? What kind of people? What kind of programmers?
I'd say at the moment, Persix is in terms of Recudo as an implementation. I'd say it's kind of for the sort of early adoptery type. It's for the people who want to explore a new tool and sort of look at it and say, okay, what can I kind of get from this? So I'd say that we're sort of at the early adopter stage now, the stage where people who really just don't have time for messing around and just want to, you know, get stuff done, that we're not quite at that point yet. If we were more at the point where you're saying, this looks like an interesting language, I want to learn it, or this looks like something that I'm going to want to use, or I can cope with a few hiccups here and there, then you know it's more the kind of thing that's ready for you today.
A question about concurrency. Mm-hmm. Some languages are starting to make concurrency into a core feature of the language. Mm-hmm. Are there any plans to do that for Persix?
Yeah, and I've actually skirted over some of the issues around that today. So when I actually showed you all the way back earlier the pipeline operator, that is one of the places in the Persix language where the specification says it's completely okay to take each of the stages of the pipeline and spawn some kind of, you know, thread or threads for each one if it makes sense to do so, and actually do a producer-consumer model there. Similarly, the hyper operators, which are doing operations over a whole list, or when I did the, remember I wrote the syntax, oops, wrong way around. Typing is hard. Like this to actually call a method on everything in a list. Well, this is another point where you're not only just doing an operation over a list, you're saying to the compiler, at this point, you're completely welcome to go and, you know, do this in a multi-threaded way. Maybe break the list into two or three parts and, you know, send them to each core. So we've got a lot of that kind of declarative parallelism in Persix. We haven't actually implemented it yet, but we have a lot of places where the language says, if you're using this construct, you're declaring up front that it's okay for me to do parallel code here. So that's part of the approach, really. It's kind of encouraging people to write programs that are inherently parallelizable, but making it the easy and convenient thing for them to do. Yes, of course, there will be ways just to spawn a thread, just, you know, traditionally, as you would have done as well. But I think for the, you know, we're kind of trying to take the, not only the task parallelism approach that spawn this thread and do this thing in parallel gives you, but also the data parallelism approach of, I have all of this data, you know, figure out a way to break it up and do this in parallel.
Questions from Stavanger. Mm-hmm. What do you have to pay to get Recudo? How much money does it cost?
Recudo?
Yeah.
To get it? It's free. You can go and download it from recudo.org. There's a Get Recudo link on the website, and you can download it today. the latest. We basically put out a release each month of the compiler, which isn't really what you want anymore. Since a couple of months ago, we're putting out what we call distribution releases. A distribution release is a release that contains not only the compiler, but also a PDF ebook, which helps you get started. And also, that's an open source book as well, by the way. So if you find bugs in it, please submit corrections. And also a bunch of kind of early Perl 6 modules that you might want to use as well. Things like MySQL database stuff, the native call thing I showed you, and a whole bunch of others. The coming probably in the next one will actually be a module installation tool as well. And we're actually calling those series of distribution releases, the name you're looking for is Recudo Star. So we actually have a different release series, which is, you know, the kind of more consumer release, if you like.
Yes. Okay, we have room for one more question.
Yes, and it's a highly practical one. You mentioned modules.
Mm-hmm.
Where will one find the Perl 6 modules? Is it on CPAN? Or how will one distinguish Perl 5 modules from Perl 6 modules?
I think it's important that we don't just go and upload Perl 6 modules to CPAN as it exists today and cause a lot of confusion. At the moment, the approach is that we have a modules.perl6.org, which is a place you can go to, and it lists all of the kind of known Perl 6 modules that are out there today. What we actually want to do is use the CPAN infrastructure, you know, all of the FTP servers and, you know, the replication and all of that lot, but actually build a kind of Perl 6 interface instead, so that the Perl 5, you know, search.cpan.org isn't going to go and pick up all of this Perl 6 stuff. Instead, you'll probably go to something like modules.perl6.org and you'll have a user interface there that is based around this. But for now, we have sort of a stopgap solution there. And you can visit that and find all the modules that are out there today. And if you write one, then it's dead easy to get it added to that list as well.
All right. I think that's about it. We're running out of tape. If you guys are interested in learning more and talking about this, there's a group called Oslo Perlmongers having meetings first Tuesday every month. It's on oslo.pm.org. Figure out when and where we meet. Other than that, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.